As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Member SIPC. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Bring in Michael Darden now, as I said, chief economist at MKM Partners. And let's start with that interview in the Wall Street Journal. There have been a series of these. He spoke to Fox Business yesterday. There was sort of an extended interview with the Financial Times a week ago as well. To me, this one had the greatest deal of substance, especially when it comes to the relationship with China and foreign exchange. Let's start with the dollar and what he declared in that interview. Michael, as somebody who's an investor, an economist, what did you make of what he had to say?
Well, that was unusual. It's unusual for a president to weigh in on the foreign exchange value of the dollar. Typically, the Treasury does that. And ultimately, the Federal Reserve is the one that has the influence there. But where I'd like to take this is, if President Trump really does believe that the dollar's too strong, that it's overvalued, what impact will that have on, you know, his selection to for future Fed appointments? We have three open board seats on the Fed that he can fill. He can also choose to replace Fed Chair Yellen and Vice Chair Fisher as their terms come up next year. The presumption is that, you know, the Trump administration would move towards a more hawkish Fed, but that doesn't really jibe with his statements about the dollar being too strong. So maybe that aspect of conventional wisdom will ultimately be turned on his head, and we won't see a move to a more hawkish Fed. Or something that came up earlier on TV, maybe he ends up asking Yellen to stay on. That would be a big shocker. It's not my call, but I think we need to at least, you know, put that out there.
Just let me ask you about sort of what this means in terms of process. Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, was traveling in Germany. He was going to the G7 finance ministers meeting, and our colleague Michael McKee asked him who speaks for the administration on currency, and he said in no uncertain terms, it is the president who does. He also said, though, we should stay tuned for this semi-annual report from the Treasury Department on foreign exchange and currencies. We're looking ahead to that. That's supposed to come out here within the month. He's been preempted by the president. I mean, is there going to be anything in that you'll be looking to, or does this sort of settle things, what the president said yesterday?
No, I think we know at this point that China will not be labeled a currency manipulator. And the president's views on the dollar are that he doesn't want it strengthening. He has a commitment to try to revive manufacturing. And so, a rising or high dollar sort of is a headwind in the face of that agenda. So I don't, expect any big surprises from the report.
All right, Michael, where would the next surprise come from? We've been pretty surprised, right, over the last two weeks. Are we going to go back to talking about tax reform, or will healthcare really take precedence?
Well, that's a great point. I mean, there was just a story out on Bloomberg yesterday that had quoted the president saying we need to move healthcare reform before we do tax reform. And the conventional wisdom after the ACA repeal and replace face planted was that, we were going to move on to tax reform because that would be easier. The Treasury Secretary actually even, made a statement similar to that. So now it looks like we might be looking at another attempt to do health care reform before tax reform. And I think these things are, it's being demonstrated that much easier said than done. Just the rifts within the Republican Party itself, within Congress, let alone the Senate, are making sweeping changes quite difficult.
But so, Michael, would he not go for an easy win? Does he need to prove that he has the party together and he has the backing? And if that's the case, why focus on health care and not focus on something easier to get through?
Yeah, that's a good point, too. I mean, I think ultimately, you know, the administration will be forced to go for, quote unquote, an easy win, meaning that the changes, whether it's regulation or taxation or health care, I think are going to be much more marginal. And, you know, you could characterize that as, quote unquote, easy win. But sweeping changes, I think, are going to be very, very, very difficult with the divisions in Congress and the bare, you know, thin majority in the U.S. Senate.
Let's talk a bit about trade. It was on the agenda at that summit in Mar-a-Lago in Florida last week. The president talking with his Chinese counterpart a bit about it. Help us with the path forward here. A few days before that, you had the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, saying that he's now embarking on a 90-day undertaking to look at bad trade deals, I suppose, looking at this on a company-by-company basis. What do you expect the result of that to be in terms of what the administration does next? How did they leave things, I guess I'm asking, in Mar-a-Lago?
You know, what I'll be looking for is, I think what we need to focus on, or what markets care about, is we just need to avoid moving policy in an anti-growth direction, meaning, you end up with a trade war, you know, taking place, or a move towards aggressively protectionist policies, a Smoot-Hawley 2.0. And that, you know, those risks look like, if anything, they've receded recently, which is, you know, which is a positive at the margin. But the idea that we can just go in and cookie cutter renegotiate quote-unquote bad trade deals, I think, is something of a myth. You know, the reality is we're probably not looking at sweeping changes there, and if there are sweeping changes, it would probably be to the negative side, and that's something we definitely want to avoid.
You know, I asked you about sort of, I was referencing the comment from Steve Mnuchin about who speaks for the administration on currency. When it comes to trade, do we have a clear sense of that? I mentioned Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross, Robert Lighthizer, the nominee to be U.S. Trade Representative, his nomination still held up in Congress, and then Peter Navarro floating on the periphery as well, heading up this National Trade Council. Do you have a sense of who's speaking for the administration, and how complicating is it to have these three people all fighting over this issue?
Right. Well, it does, you know, make for a bit of confusion when you hear the president or you hear Mr. Navarro speak about trade. You definitely are getting, you know, the populist, nationalist view, you know, more protectionist. But the other voices in Treasury, at least, seem to be pushing the other way. So while that creates confusion, I also think it's an important firebreak against, you know, radical and potentially disruptive and damaging you know, policies in terms of moving towards aggressive trade protectionism or some kind of a trade war.
Michael, is there a danger, and we've talked a little bit about this also on TV, that if he doesn't get healthcare through, that if he doesn't get tax reform through, then to get that easier win, he goes back to, you know, tariffs, adjusted border tax, or things like that?
I think so. I mean, it's interesting. If you look at the history of the president, you know, his views on policies have evolved and changed over time. There's a lot of fluidity there. But on one specific issue, trade, going all the way back to the late 80s, I think he's run for president at least temporarily in every cycle.
There you go. Yeah.
Going back to the late 80s, he's had this view of trade that's mercantilist, nationalistic, and zero sum. And so that is a concern, at least for me, and I think it's a concern for markets as well.
Just about 30 seconds left. We'll come back here, Michael, in just a bit. To what degree are you paying attention to Washington? When you look at investment writ large, how big a role is Washington playing?
Well, it's probably overstated. I mean, as we saw with the attempt with repeal and replace, it didn't go anywhere. Very difficult to get sweeping changes to take place. That said, there is a big focus on it. And certainly in the client meetings that I've been doing, we spend a lot of time talking about Washington, and then everybody complains that they're spending too much time talking about it and thinking about it. So it's definitely topical.
David Gurr with Francine Lockwood today. Tom Keene is on vacation this week, back in the chair on Monday. This is Bloomberg Surveillance on Bloomberg Radio. We're talking with Michael Darda of MKM Partners. He's the chief economist there. And let's talk a little bit about the Fed. There's been so much attention being paid now to the balance sheet. The parlor game shifts its focus from rate increases, at least partially, to the balance sheet. Give us a sense of what you're thinking in light of what we've read from the minutes of the March meeting, in light of what we've heard from governors and presidents, and from Chair Yellen herself.
So my thinking is that it looks like the Fed is basically on this course of quarter to quarter, you know, rate hikes, 25 basis points per quarter until or unless something goes wrong, or, as you mentioned, until they decide to start shrinking the balance sheet. And then New York Fed President Dudley said recently that when they do begin that process, probably they'll pause on the rate hikes for a while just to see how financial markets and liquidity conditions are developing. So I think, you know, the dot plot gives us some sense of, you know, what the consensus view is on the Fed in terms of prospective rate rises. So probably two more this year. But I wouldn't rule out four if the data stays decent. I think they're going to continue to go quarter to quarter. If we end up with, you know, much weaker data or disruptive volatility, meaning to the extent that it looks like it might threaten the business cycle, they'll clearly stop. But I think, you know, the base case scenario is quarter by quarter rate hikes until they start to work on the balance sheet probably later this year, early next year.
So we proceed apace. I wonder sort of what would constitute an event big enough to derail moving ahead in the way that they want to?
Well, at least from my perspective, you know, I'll be watching three indicators. One is credit markets. So when the Fed initially started the taper and then was talking up rate rises, we started to see a big move up in the dollar and then pressure on credit markets. The conventional wisdom, as we talked about on TV this morning, was that it was just an oil market story, but we did see a slowdown in the business cycle in the U.S. We had really from late 14 into the middle of last year, a pretty big deceleration in year-over-year nominal and even real GDP growth. So the conventional view was falling oil will boost growth, but in fact, that was not the case. So I'll be watching credit markets very closely and inflation expectations, and then some of the monetary aggregates that don't include excess reserves, like M1 money growth, for example. That one weakened a lot coming into early last year and now is recovered back into recovery ranges. So if those indicators look healthy, then I don't think we need to worry about the Fed either raising rates further or potentially shrinking the balance sheet. If those indicators are rolling over, then we're going to have to worry more. And then it's, you know, there's some subjectivity in terms of what constitutes a material weakening, but I would just say a sustained, you know, adverse move in any or all of those indicators, and I would become increasingly worried.
Worried meaning, Michael, that it would actually stop the Fed from hiking? What needs to happen for the Fed to actually say, you know what, one rate hike, if at all, this year?
Well, I think you'd need to see ongoing softness in the macro data. So there's some concern that Q1 GDP looks weak. I think it's, you know, we'll have to see what the numbers suggest and then whether there's a bounce back in Q2. But the payroll figures, you know, we got a disappointing report for March. But keep in mind that underlying organic labor force growth is probably only 75K to 125K. And if it turns out that headline number on payrolls, if it turns out that we either get upward revisions or we're bouncing back, the Fed's going to want to tighten further to temper that. So I think you'd need pretty weak data in a sustained fashion, or what looks like disruptive volatility shocks.
Is that dollar strength?
It could be, but I think it would be. They're not going to react to the dollar per se. But if the dollar is moving, coupled with adverse moves in credit markets and inflation expectations, then they will definitely take note. It took a while for them to wake up to that, moving into 2016, but they eventually did move to the sidelines, and that was ultimately the right move. Conditions stabilized, and then the Fed was able to start raising rates late last year, and was, you know, and then followed up, just recently, and those moves were not disruptive because they properly, you know, paused for a period of time. So no need to go there at this juncture. I don't think, that we're looking at those kinds of disruptions. So I think they'll be able to continue with quarter-to-quarter moves.
All right, Michael Darda, thanks so much for joining us today, both on radio and television. Great to see you once again. Michael Darda, Chief Economist with MKM Partners here in our 1130 studios in New York. Ken Leon, who was kind enough to join us on television earlier this morning, as well as we got those J.P. Morgan earnings. And before we dig into the numbers in specific here, Ken, let me just ask you about broad themes. Fran and I were talking about the contrast here between equities trading and fixed income. What are you seeing shape up when you look at J.P. Morgan and you look at Citi this morning?
The key area is really in capital markets, where very strong for J.P. Morgan. It was mixed at best for Citi. This may suggest some market share gains for J.P. Morgan. You know, obviously always near the top in terms of the league rankings for equity, fixed income underwriting, et cetera. Citi trading also in areas related to equities was okay, but it seems that the year-over-year comparisons for Citi were at best okay. They did a beat in terms of $1.25 versus $1.10 last year, but we really don't see across the board the same strength that we've seen in J.P. Morgan's results today.
How much of a surprise was it to you when you got the read on fixed income trading from J.P. Morgan, again, beating estimates with some significance there? How big a surprise was that to you?
First quarter is typically the strongest quarter for fixed income trading, and then in a rising rate environment and a little bit more of risk-taking by, let's call it, institutional clients, all this led to very strong results. We also got an indication of this really from the monthly market exchange data that we get.
Ken, talk to me a little bit about Citigroup. So we're just getting the story, generating the most revenue from fixed income trading in 3 years. Are you concerned that they won't be able to keep it up?
It's likely that for this year that we will see flat to up single digit for fixed income trading. A lot relates to investor confidence, risk taking, and fixed income trading along with equities really have not seen a lot of volatility. Volatility tends to initially be good for trading revenue like fixed income, and then it creates kind of a pocket where investors are on the sidelines.
Citigroup, the consumer bank, revenue increasing 1%. That's actually a touch below what analysts were expecting. Is that their kind of Achilles heel?
Yeah, that's right. So I don't think it speaks to the economy, the confidence of, you know, of the consumer. You know, when you look at the products related to consumer lending, you know, I would want to see numbers like, you know, 3-4% growth, and it was only 1% for Citi. You know, Citi doesn't have the breadth franchise in domestic consumer banking. They are very strong in credit cards, though.
Where are the deficits as you see them? When you look at these two earnings reports, where are the problem spots that stand out to you?
The problem spots really relate to, as the last question, with the consumer, confidence. Confidence from the CEOs for M&A. Mergers and acquisitions was actually down year over year, but it was made up by strong debt and equity underwriting, particularly IPOs like Snap in the first quarter, where J.P. Morgan was the lead, Citi was in it as well. So that's one area. Second area would be related to anything on, as it speaks to the business climate and regulation. Right now, it's pretty much business as usual. Again, it may not be in the results, but on expectations that in a Trump administration and pro-business, over the course of 2017, we're going to see some easing on some of the guidelines, whether it be Dodd-Frank or some of the agencies in terms of how they interpret bank regulation.
We're talking with Ken Leon of CFRA here as we get results from Citi and Wells. Got results a little earlier this morning from J.P. Morgan, just to get everyone up to speed on where things stand. We're going through those earnings reports now. J.P. Morgan starting its call with reporters. That's just underway. And again, you can follow along at TLIV. Go on the Bloomberg as you listen to us here. Ken, you mentioned looking ahead to what may or may not happen out of Washington. How important to banks, to the bank's bottom line, is some sort of reform of financial regulation in the U.S.?
So the managements, are very conservative. They're kind of living with the condition of Dodd-Frank. I think it gets into some of the areas or products that they can get involved in with a little bit more risk-taking. No one's going to remove capital requirements or put the banks or the country at risk. But it's more on the edge, that ability to maybe enable them to take capital and put it in the principal into a little bit of riskier areas to get higher returns. I don't think it's the return of prop trading. That's not going to happen. But I think the mandate from the Trump administration, both for the SEC, perhaps with the appointments over the next 18 months with the Federal Reserve, is more of an accommodative environment for banks.
We got about 30 seconds here before we'll go to break. We'll come back with you in just a little bit here. But let me ask you, Ken, what we learned from Jamie Dimon this morning in terms of his outlook on the economy. We had his letter to shareholders last week or the week before. It's all a fog. I can't remember which. But what did we learn today about the economy?
Yeah, so especially in the meat and potato areas of banking, which is consumer bank lending and also business, particularly small business, it's very good. We're seeing up indicators for employment. We're seeing consumers still confident, which means that the housing market is still very good, and consumer loans, including auto loans, are good as well.
Ken, we haven't talked about Wells Fargo. We approached those earnings a little bit differently, Fran and I were discussing before we went to you on the phone. Obviously, there's this fake account scandal still looming. When is this bank going to get beyond it? We saw the clawbacks just a couple of days ago of John Stumpf's pay package. How desperate is this bank to get beyond it, and when's it going to happen?
Well, it really starts with the senior management, and even in today's earnings release, there's a tone of talking about culture and doing right for the customer in the earnings release. With that, it also ties to how they measure performance for employees, particularly those, who are at the bank branches, et cetera. So all this is part of rebuilding their brand. It's going to take some time. The results are okay. They're not great. But this is more of a traditional commercial lending bank than one like J.P. Morgan, which is global in all respects for the capital markets and investment banking.
Can we talk at some length on this show about the European banks? And you look at Credit Suisse, you look at Deutsche Bank, you've got chief executives who have big plans to turn those banks around, turn them into new entities. What's a Jamie Dimon or what's Mr. Corbett thinking as he looks overseas to Europe and thinks about the role that he could play in rejiggering or reinventing banks here based in the U.S.?
I think what we're going to hear from Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan at 8:30 on the call is going to be that, their rankings in Europe in particular is number one or two, and they are taking market share as some of the major European banks, whether it be Deutsche Bank, Credit Suisse, UBS, et cetera, continue to be shifting away from the investment banking capital market areas, sometimes a little bit riskier, in trading, to the more conservative wealth management areas.
Ken, you're breaking my heart. I'm in London. Is some European CEO at some point going to say enough is enough? Or is it regulation that they'll say, well, the U.S. is deregulating or making their banks' jobs easier, we're going to do the same?
Yeah, so it's almost like a two-tier issue as it relates to the U.K. and Europe, of course, with Brexit. And where employees are going to be working under the new regimes. But, I think part of what we're seeing in Europe, the economies are coming back, business is getting better, but the strategies for the large banks seems to be a lot more conservative than before. Given some of the leading U.S. banks, J.P. Morgan, Citi, they're in a position just to gain share because they fixed some of those problems a little bit earlier.
Are we expecting consolidation or some of the U.S. banks? Because you guys are so much stronger, although price to book, it's looking a lot more expensive than the European banks. Can we expect some of the big U.S. majors to come in Europe and buy things?
It's a very good question, and I would say probably not. I mean, when you look at, unless there's some unusual situation, but generally, I think most of the major U.S. banks have feet on the ground, if you will, in terms of a presence in both traditional investment banking and lending.
I'm wondering here as we look ahead to what may or may not happen in Washington, just to reprise that in the last few seconds that we have with you here on surveillance. the degree to which we know what regulatory reform lawmakers may be considering, whether it's going to be something that's going to come out of Congress, what banks are agitating for. We talk about regulation and reform of regulation with a broad brush. What's likely to happen? What's likely to make the biggest difference to these banks?
Well, you know, banks come in all different sizes, and I think for most banks in the U.S., it's trying to get out of a lot of the restrictions from Dodd-Frank just because they're so small. When you're talking about the larger global banks as we are today, it's really more fine-tuning. They are still going to be bound by Dodd-Frank, by a lot of the capital ratios, and where there's some wiggle room, it might be in some areas where they want to get into perhaps some trading products or businesses, but not in any big strokes. So I think generally, when we think of deregulation, it's going to be to give something more for the smaller banks. And I think that's part of the mandate from the Trump administration.
All right, Ken Leon, thanks very much for joining us today, both on Bloomberg Surveillance on radio and television. Ken Leon of CFRA joining us on our phone lines.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC.
He was for 6 years the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. He's now the Lionel McKenzie Professor of Economics at the University of Rochester. Narayana Kuchalakota is also, I should point out, a columnist for Bloomberg View, and he joins us on our phone line. Great to have you with us. And I know Francine Lacqua eager to jump in here with some questions. Francine?
Yeah, thank you so much, Mr. Kuchalakota. Great pleasure to have you, because this is the day after the interview that we've all read where President Trump for the first time is hinting that he's open to keeping Janet Yellen at the helm of the Fed. Will he?
Well, thanks. First of all, thanks for having me on. I don't know for sure what President Trump will do, but I was very heartened by his comments about Chair Yellen. I think that it shows that he's thinking about that job in the right way, which is, you know, Chair Yellen has done what she is supposed to do as chair of the Fed, which is to keep unemployment low and to have inflation be close to target. That's what you're looking for in terms of what the chair is supposed to be achieving in their job, and so I think it's going to be very hard for President Trump to find good reasons for to say that the chair has not been doing her job.
Right, and he also said that he likes low interest rate policies. Right, this is again a reversal to what he's said in the past. But have you ever met a president that didn't like low interest rate policy?
Well, there's some truth to that. Although I think that actually, if you track what President Trump has said in the past on monetary policy, he has said he sometimes sounded extremely hawkish, expressed positive sentiments towards the gold standard. I think on an occasion. On the other hand, he's also in the past expressed recognition for why low interest rates are valuable for business in terms of being able to in terms of being able to stimulate growth in demand. So. I think yesterday we heard the dovish President Trump. We might hear from the hawkish President Trump down the road as well. But certainly, if you have a pro-growth agenda, as the president has voiced, low interest rates are going to be your friend there. And the challenge for the Fed is, look, they're not about keeping interest rates low. Their job is to keep inflation at target and keep employment at maximum. And they have to just and they will, I know, not pay any attention to what the president's preferences are on this matter.
Do they have to? I mean, I think of what he said yesterday, and I think about this ongoing debate in Washington about the prospects for fiscal stimulus. Did what he say yesterday give them any more grounds to debate this, and when they next meet, say, in Washington?
Well, I think a big question for the Fed is not so much the president's preferences for low interest rates, but rather how likely is fiscal stimulus, and then what is that fiscal stimulus going to mean for the economy in terms of inflationary pressures? And I guess you could say the president, as comments yesterday, made infrastructure made it clear the administration is still very, very much pro infrastructure. But beyond that, You know, it's really everything that the president says is really trying to, they're trying to filter into what's the outlook for the economy, what's the outlook for inflation and employment going to be. I personally, you know, if I was still on the committee, wouldn't take too much from one interview along those lines.
Mm. Let me ask you about the balance sheet, the Fed weighing what to do with this $4.5 trillion balance sheet, the debate now seeming to center on whether or not the Fed can effectively unwind that balance sheet while continuing to raise rates. What's your, I've used the analogy, can the Fed walk and chew gum at the same time? How difficult is it going to be for the Fed to do both?
Yeah, first of all, there's really no need, I certainly said this when I was a committee member, I can say it now again, there's really no reason for the Fed to reduce the balance sheet. It can continue to tighten economic conditions as needed with the current size of the balance sheet. So there's really no need for it to reduce the balance sheet. Eventually, the number, as the economy continues to grow, and this is a long ways off, the amount of excess reserves that the banking system has will return to pre-crisis levels just because of growth in the economy. So there's no real reason for why the Fed has to reduce the balance sheet. With that said, there's a lot of discussion, as you and your listeners have heard, about the whether or not the Fed will change its reinvestment policy. It would be the sort of the first step. I think the important thing for the Fed is not to think about the balance sheet as some separate object off on the side, but rather as part of a collective package of stimulus. So if you're going to start halting reinvestments, for example, that's got to mean that you're going to be raising rates more slowly, because your ultimate objective is to be achieving inflation of 2% and maximum employment. If you're halting reinvestments, that's going to be tightening policy through your balance sheet, and then you're going to want to keep rates lower than you would otherwise.
Right. So what is the one key data point that actually you would be looking at this point to give us clues on policy timing?
Well, you know, I think that from the Fed's point of view, so I'll talk first from the Fed's point of view, and then I'll give a couple of my own thoughts. I think the Fed is continuing to watch unemployment. I think that they are, you know, the chair said earlier this week that unemployment was now lower than what the committee as a whole saw sustainable over the long run. That's something of concern if you listen to Fed speakers. And they're not going to be happy with that continuing to be true for over an extended period. And that's why I think they worry that if they don't continue to tighten gradually, they're going to have to tighten very rapidly at some point and cause a recession. My own view is that unemployment is not a great metric for the health of the labor market right now. We really continue to be watching employment. The big question is, you know, how can you bring in people off the sidelines back into the workforce without generating undue wage pressures and inflationary pressures? We've seen had so much success in the last 3 to 4 years on that dimension. I would really like to see the Fed continue to keep stimulus in place, be very patient about raising rates in order to stimulate demand, bring in more workers who are currently people who would work who are currently not in the labor force. I think you can do that without generating wage or inflationary pressures.
Right. In the little time we have left, can I ask you about the overseas market? We're seeing about $3 trillion of negative yielding government bonds have turned, you know, turning positive in recent months. What does that mean for Treasury buying?
You know, I think the Treasury market continues to be one of the most liquid in the world. And so I think what that means is that, you know, individual price movements don't have really big effects on the state of demand for Treasuries. I think we can be pretty comfortable and continue to be comfortable that Treasuries are just a if one kind of buyer steps away from the market, there's another buyer who's going to be willing to step in at a price that's very close to what that previous buyer was paying. So I don't see these moves as being very material at this point.
Great to speak with you, as always. Dariana Kochalakota, the former president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, now the Lionel McKenzie Professor of Economics at the University of Rochester.
I've been looking forward to this interview all day. We're now joined by the Minister of State for Petroleum Resources of Nigeria. He is one Emmanuel Ibe Kachichku. And Minister, you join us from a 99.1 Studios in Washington. I remember a great interview that you gave me here in London. And of course, one of your strongest points, apart from being a great analyst, is also having a wonderful Twitter page. So I urge everyone to go and follow you, sir, on there. You're in D.C., actually meeting with the Exxon CEO. Will you be talking about OPEC or investments?
Largely investments. We've already had that meeting. Meeting took place in Dallas yesterday. And we focused, on my own side, I focused on trying to see what we needed to do to remove whatever restrictions are there to enable ExxonMobil to invest more in Nigeria. On their own side, they also went through the processes and the concerns that they have as the available funds for investments are tightening by the day, and so countries have got to compete for this. And so they laid out what their concerns were in the fiscal areas and the policy areas and what we needed to do to get a bigger portion of that pie.
Minister, on a larger scale, how can Nigeria secure the necessary investment to boost output as long as, for example, the oil-producing Delta region remains unsafe?
Well, I wouldn't use the word unsafe. It's actually becoming safe. Over the last 3 months, we haven't had an incident. We're beginning to engage them a lot more deeply to remove the militancy issues. Our production is beginning to go up. We're beginning to address some of the systemic fiscal issues that have been in the systems, fiscal and policy issues. We recently renegotiated the arrears of debt and indebtedness of the oil companies, worth over $6 billion. Worked out a five-year program on how to pay for that. Worked out a new process of cash call payments. Mm-hmm. So we're taking bullishly the issues that we needed to take on. So I think the climate is getting better. Clearly, for countries who have been very stable in this sort of area, especially Gulf countries, we have some catching up to do. We need to run fairly fast to be able to catch up with the getting our environment sane and clean and clear and inviting for investors.
Minister, since you're meeting the Exxon CEO, I want to talk a little bit more about some of the oil majors. Nigeria, for example, has filed corruption charges against Shell, but also Eni, for allegedly paying bribes to secure an oil block. What's going to be the next step in that process?
Well, I've tried to distinguish between the issues of criminality involved, mm-hmm. and it's essential that for transparency purposes, we deal with those issues. And like you know, our president is very focused on a massive anti-corruption drive to clean up the system. So that's welcome. But that's not taking away the advantage of the big fields, Bonga, Southwest, Zabazaba, they're all part of pursuant to these blocks. So what I've said is we're going to put it in two different dimensions. One, save the existing deals so that way at least we can continue the massive investment and growth that we're trying to see in the oil area on this field. This field is going to train cumulatively over 400,000 barrels into the system. But then we need to go back and look at the transaction itself. And frankly, if over $1 billion was paid as bribes to individuals in whichever mm-hmm. way, then that is money belonging to the government that was under the table. And we need to find a way of sitting down with the oil companies to get better terms and get back some of that money back on the table.
Minister, the IEA today said global oil inventories probably increased in the first quarter. However, they also said that OPEC's implementation is near perfect. Do you expect OPEC to extend production cuts into the second half?
I'm not sure we have an alternative. We've got to. That is what has kept the market stable at this sort of over $50 price per barrel that we've seen over the last one and a half months. So we need to overextend that when that ends in June. We need to continue to monitor and ensure that the efficiency, there's absolute efficiency in terms of compliance. But more important than that, we need to begin to collaboratively bring in other players who have so far not participated. U.S. is a big issue because they've so far not been very willing to have conversations on this. And in any case, the shale production in U.S. is throwing quite some numbers back into the field and so complicating the dynamics of monitoring. But ultimately, I'm one of those who are optimistic that somewhere down the road, everybody, us, Russia, the U.S. and the rest of them, will see the need for a very stable oil market, mm-hmm. Both for consumers and for producers.
But would Nigeria actually join the others in cutting production if the deal is extended? For the moment, you're actually exempt from having to cut.
Yes, we're exempt because of the unique issues we have in the Niger Delta area. My anticipation is that if all things being equal, if the infrastructure is repaired and all that, somewhere around the October-November timeframe, you see us back into proper production numbers. And once we do that, then we're obviously willing to join the cuts. We're a very strong member of OPEC and would like to support OPEC.
Minister, talk to me a little bit more about your trip to Texas. So when do you leave D.C. to go there?
No, I came from Texas.
Have you just come back, right?
Yes. Trip was largely, I've been going around most of the chairman suits in most of the major oil companies. I did Eni about a month ago. I've just done ExxonMobil. I'll be doing Chevron during the OTC next month. And I'm lined up to do the same thing for Total and for Shell. The whole idea is leave whatever the local managerial policies are. Let's talk to the big players. Let's talk to the guys who make the decision. See what it is we need to do. See what their perception of the policies that I'm putting in place are. See what areas of collaboration we can do and ensure that we're getting a big piece of that investment. And also I'm challenging them to stop looking at Nigeria just in terms of crude oil production, but also to diversify their businesses.
What was the one thing that surprised you the most in Texas?
I won't call it a surprise. I've been a member of that team. Like you know, I worked for ExxonMobil for nearly 15, 16 years of my career before I left to this job. So I could predictably tell where they will stand. Where do they stand? The need for firmer policies, need for transparency to continue in the way we're doing it, need for better fiscal conditions to enable them to continue to put some of the investment funds that they have towards Nigeria than towards other developing competing nations. But more important and more focused is the fact that they reiterated the fact that as far as they are concerned, investing in Nigeria was key for them. Nigeria was a key
Minister.
Market. Yes.
Thank you so much. It's always a great pleasure to speak to the Minister of State for Petroleum and Resources of Nigeria.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.